This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, horticultural historian Jennifer Potter tells us about seven flowers and how they shaped our world, and writer and critic Andrew Muller shares with us his favourite album of the 21st century so far. Jennifer Potter is a horticultural historian who writes about the history and culture of plants, plantsmen and gardens. She is the author of four novels and five works of non-fiction, including Strange Blooms, The Curious Lives and Adventures of the John Tradescants, and The Rose, A True History. A regular reviewer for the Times Literary Supplement, she is currently a Royal Literary Fund Fellow at King's College London. Her latest book is Seven Flowers and How They Shaped Our World, and so that's what we're going to be talking about in this interview. So Jennifer, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, this is a book about seven flowers, so I guess first of all we should talk about why those seven flowers. How did you manage to narrow it down to seven?
I had spent about 5 years investigating the hidden histories of the rose, and I came to the end of that book, and you might think I'd had enough of flowers for a bit, but not a bit of it. I thought that I was fascinated by the way we tell our stories through the rose. And I thought, if we do this through the rose, what about other flowers? Mm-hmm. So the idea was to take seven flowers that have exerted power or influence of one kind or another. I wanted flowers from around the world, and I also wanted flowers that had some connection with my life. Mm-hmm. And the ones I came up with, it's interesting, the first six more or less chose themselves. They were flowers I absolutely had to do. There is the lotus, the lily, the sunflower, the opium poppy, the tulip, and the rose. Those are the first six. And it was only as I'd finished the sixth flower that I finally decided which would be my seventh flower, and it's the orchid. And if you think about them, they've all exerted a different kind of power and a different kind of influence. And we'll talk about them in some detail. But the reason I included the orchid was, to me, it's a flower I don't particularly like, or I certainly didn't like it when I started researching it. But people get totally obsessed by the orchid. Unlike the others, it doesn't have medical power like the opium poppy, doesn't have a religious power like the lotus and the lily. It's just, it exerts this strange fascination. And seeing as I was completely cold to that, I thought I should include that. So those are my seven flowers.
So was there any that were nearly made it and then didn't? If this was a book of 10 flowers that changed our world, which were the ones that were just sort of bubbling under?
Okay, if there were 10... I would certainly have included the peony. And I was rather sad not to include the peony because I adore peonies. And my very favourite flower of all is a peony called Molly the Witch. It's actually got a Russian name that I absolutely can't pronounce, and that's why everyone calls it Molly the Witch. And it has this wonderful, clear, lemony colour. An extraordinary flower. And the peony is very resonant in Chinese culture and also in Japanese culture. So, very sad not to include the peony. People have said to me, why didn't I include the chrysanthemum? Because that too is very, very important culturally in the Far East, particularly in Japan. And in France, it's the flower of funerals. But to be perfectly honest, I never thought of including the chrysanthemum. I just don't like them. Sorry.
You've got to write about them. It's important that you care.
You've got to write about them. And, okay, I may not have liked the orchid at the beginning, but I became totally fascinated by it. And the other one was a flower that hardly anyone has heard of. It's a flower from Australia. Mm-hmm. It's endemic to Australia and Tasmania. And it's called the waratah.
No, I haven't heard of that.
No, it's actually, it looks a bit like a kind of chrysanthemum. This usually, I think the main colour is this flaming crimson. And it's the only flower that I know of that has a place in Aboriginal myth. And I think that would have been very interesting to have included it. And it's also the flower when Australians were trying to develop their own design and cultural identity towards the end of the 19th century. The waratah was used in stylized design, much as we used the lily and the sunflower. So I'm sad not to have included that, but it's odd. Seven Flowers as a title sounds very much better than Ten Flowers.
It does. I mean,
there is something extraordinary about the number seven, and seven was right. I think ten would have been getting a little tired, particularly me as the writer. But
well, if it was ten, it could have been. It could have been 20. If it was 20,
it could have been 20. Yes. Yeah.
So, okay. Well, we're gonna, as we go through the show, we'll look at each of the flowers in turn. So we're looking at there's only seven and not 100.
Right.
Oh, it would have been a long show. The first one, then, the lotus, and the obvious thing that leaps out immediately about the lotus is it's a flower that we won't be familiar with particularly over here. It's a flower of the middle and the far east, but it's not something that you'd see growing in people's gardens here. And the book has illustrations, but also like paintings and things. But also, it's obviously a flower that I know and I've heard of, and particularly through its cultural resonances, but I've had to look it up.
That's interesting. In the book, I include two lotuses. There's the true lotus, which I'll come on to talk about. But there's, first of all, it's the ancient Egyptian lotus, which is actually a water lily.
Yeah.
Nymphaea carinaea. There's the blue water lily and the white water lily. And the reason they're important, the reason they're in the book, is they were part of the old creation myths of the ancient Egyptians. And there was the idea, it's a very, very beautiful. We're talking about the day-blooming blue water lily, which it stands about 20 to 30 centimetres out of the water. That's the bud. And it opens with the dawn. And sometime after midday, it drops back down into the water and continues that cycle for another 2 days. This is why it's in some of the early creation myths that on the very first day, on the dawn of the first day, the water lily appears, it opens, and it releases the sun god, Ra, who travels across the horizon, has a symbolic death at the end of the day, and then rises again in the next day. So that's the ancient Egyptian lotus. But the true lotus, you're right, it's native to India and China. And my first encounter with it was as a child or an adolescent of the late 60s. I used to go and meditate at a Tibetan monastery in the Scottish borders, Sammy Ling. And, of course, the lotus, the true lotus, Nelumbo nucifera, is very much part of Tibetan Buddhism. And so my first encounter with the lotus was as an abstract flower. And we used to meditate for hours on a Tibetan mantra that translates into English as the jewel in the heart of the lotus. The very first true lotuses I saw flowering, because you're right, they don't flower outdoors in Britain. It's just not hot.
Certainly not Scotland, I imagine.
Certainly not Scotland. No. You do find them in botanic gardens, and they're usually in the covered in the glass houses. But the first time I saw them blooming outdoors, I was blown away by them. It was in North America, a garden called Innisfree, which is up the Hudson Valley. And there's lotus, a whole, I was going to say field of lotus, but they're growing in the lake. And they hold themselves very high above the water. And they've got these wonderful leaves that are also held above the water, a sort of greyish green, very like upturned skirts. And these extraordinarily beautiful flowers, slightly pinky, with a strange head in the middle. And just beautiful. And I saw some more over in California in the Huntingdon Botanical Garden. And I fell for them. They're present in some of the early Hindu scriptures. And, of course, very much so in Buddhism as well. And in Buddhism, it's said that, they're linked to notions of spiritual enlightenment. It's said that the roots grow down in the slime of the material world, and the plant rises up through the waters of experience, and it flowers in the sunshine of enlightenment, which is just wonderful. And I had to include it. Well, not just to include it, but to begin with the lotus, because of all the flowers, it's, you know, we're talking 4,500 years ago, the ancient creation myths of the ancient Egyptians. And also there was this very strange lotus-headed goddess of the Indus civilization. Same sort of period, which is extraordinary, thousand years ago, which sort of reappeared as another Indian goddess called Lajagauri. But it had to be first, and very, very beautiful. I think all the flowers in the book are beautiful, but they've all got something beyond their beauty.
Let's talk a little bit more about the part it plays in the creation myths then, because you said both the Egyptian and the Hindu creation myths feature the lotus. It's interesting that it has quite a similar role in those two very early religions, and it's that quite simple symbolism that you described earlier of it, you know, flowering and going back in each day, which...
Yes, very much so. And you find this is in the ancient Egyptian culture and civilization. You find it in Egyptian books of the dead, which were essentially collections of spells, and you would commission a book of the dead only if you were particularly wealthy and able to afford it. And they contained spells which will help you on the all-important journey into the afterlife. And one of the spells, you can write into the book that you want to be transformed into a lotus. And there are some lovely, lovely lotus drawings with the head emerging out of a lotus. And the idea was that if you include a spell like that, then you can return from the afterlife, like Osiris, the lord of the underworld. So very embedded in ancient Egyptian culture. And, I mean, it's quite interesting how well they depicted the flowers on tombs and in these books of the dead. Because, if you remember, I said there were two sorts of lotus in ancient Egypt. There was the day-blooming blue lotus, and there was the night-blooming white lotus. And they have rather different petals. The petals of the blue lotus are much sharper. And they also have different leaves. And these are depicted very definitely. Mm-hmm. So they were including in their drawings, in their tomb paintings, the flowers that they knew. The lotus is the flower of the East, and the logo for the vegan society in the West is a sunflower, which is very recognisable, and those of us who live in the West, you know, instantly equate it with sunshine, with good things. Whereas in the East, it's the vegan society has adopted the lotus, because the lotus is the flower that resonates for them. And also in the West, we use it as a shorthand for the exotic East. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in a slightly lazy way, if you like. I think I'm being a bit rude. There's a very famous painting by one of the Glasgow boys, Edward Atkinson Hornell.
Glasgow School,
you're absolutely right. And it's called The Lotus Flower. And in the foreground, there are these huge pink and white lotuses. And behind them and slightly above them, there's floating this courtesan doing her hair. Mm-hmm. But it's our shorthand for the exotic East. And there's Pierre Loti's Madame Chrysanthemum, which became one of the models for Madame Butterfly. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of lotuses there with their sort of heavy, heady, sensual perfume.
It's surprising to hear you describe about the vegan society using that as the logo, because another way in which we ascribe the lotus in Western popular culture to the exotic East is, you know, the lotus eaters, which, you know, a sort of reference to a decadent. So I was actually surprised to discover that it is actually edible, that it is something that people
eat. Yes, but the lotus eaters, we don't know what flower was meant in the lotus eaters, which was, well, the lotus eaters appeared originally in Homer's...
Yeah, it's Tennyson that I'm thinking of. Obviously.
Tennyson is the very famous poem called The Lotus Eaters, but it's spelled L-O-T-O-S. Mm-hmm. And although we equate that with the lotus flower, it was actually a completely different plant altogether.
But what I mean was, that's still the image it has in our... That's the part it plays in the sort of Western image of it in culture.
And in culture, this sort of sensual, drowsy, decadent, sort of soporific, going off into a trance. Yes, Yes, and I think one of the reasons for writing the book was to try and untie all these strands that get all mixed up and muddled up, and just to see where they come from.
I'm John Lloyd, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I want to move us on to the lily then, which is the second flower in the book. And what I think is quite fascinating about the lily, we've been talking about some of the allusions in culture and in religions to the lotus. And what's interesting about the lily is how it does a sort of vault face in the image of it. It was once seen as a very decadent and sexual plant. And then centuries later, suddenly it's the flower of the Virgin Mary and of Christianity.
I mean, that's right. And this is true of both the lily and the rose. But we're talking about the lily, so we'll stick with the lily. Flowers were adored by the Greeks and particularly by the Romans. So flowers were used in festivals. I mean, again, this is very much the rose, but also the lily. And they used them as perfumes. And so there was a sort of decadence. And also they were very strongly aligned with paganism. So the early Christian fathers tried to ban flowers from worship. They really... Flowers were not there at the beginning of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So unlike ancient Egyptian culture, unlike Hinduism, unlike Buddhism, which are all very much older than Christianity, Christian fathers wanted nothing to do with these decadent flowers. And then it's almost as if, and remember that I'm investigating the power of flowers, if you like, it's almost as if you can't keep these flowers down, that sooner or later they will reassert themselves and exert their power and their influence. And this happened within Christianity. I think it happened earlier with the lily than it did with the rose, because already in about the 6th century there's a Byzantine church in Ravenna dedicated to St. Apollinaris. And there are some wonderful, there's a mosaic of St. Apollinaris interceding for his flock, who are represented as lambs. And it's in the landscape of paradise, and between the lambs are clumps of white lilies. So already 6th century, the lily is becoming rehabilitated, and it no longer has these dreadful pagan associations. And it becomes more and more important, and it's connected within Christianity. It's connected very much with the Virgin Mary, with the purity of the Virgin Mary. But you do find very strange lily crucifixes. They only appear in Britain in 13th, 14th century. I would dearly love to see the original. There's a Welsh Book of Hours, 14th century I think it is, which shows a scene of the Annunciation. So you've got the angel Gabriel telling Mary she's going to be the mother of Christ, and standing next to her is this strange figure of Christ crucified on a lily in a silver pot. It's a very sort of complex symbol, because it refers to notions of Mary's purity, of the idea of Christ being crucified by the Christian virtues, by which is meant that by his death he brings the Christian virtues to perfection. And lily water was also used in childbirth. So you have notions of, here you have the angel Gabriel telling Mary she's going to give birth to Christ, and you already have this notion of lilies and lily water and childbirth. And as scenes of the Annunciation evolved, in these very early ones, Gabriel is holding a palm frond. But in later ones, when you think of Botticelli's scene of the Annunciation, right the way through to, there's a rather creepy one by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, where Mary doesn't look at all happy with the news she's been given by Gabriel. She looks scared. Gabriel is always holding a lily flower, often with three buds.
I want to come back to that idea that the lily's done this, you know, is one seen as something decadent and is then seen as something pure, because the same thing happens, or at least people have seen the lotus, which we were just talking about earlier, in the same way. And actually, you describe the lily as really the European version of
the lotus but was not there at the beginning, mm-hmm. unlike the lotus, which is there very much at the beginning of the development of culture and civilization. And so
where does the lily come from, you know, in nature?
There's the white lily, which we call the Madonna lily, mm-hmm. is Lilium candidum, and there are some wonderful very early Minoan frescoes of this lily when it's already, they're painted on the walls of townhouses on Crete, and there are also some more lilies on the island of Thera, Santorini. So these are Minoan civilizations, so we're talking maybe 3,500 years ago. And already the lily is a garden flower, mm-hmm. and you need to compare that with the rose, which also appears in some of these frescoes, which is still very much a wild mm-hmm. briar. So it's thought that the white lily, Lilium candidum, the Madonna lily, originated in the Balkans. It was thought to have been taken into cultivation by the Cretans and then carried around the Mediterranean by the Phoenicians. So plants travel, mm-hmm. particularly once they've been domesticated and brought into gardens. And then they're very much prized, and they are taken by trade and by conquest. You know, you take your flowers with you.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Jennifer Potter about her book Seven Flowers and how they shaped our world. And Jennifer, we're going to move on to the sunflower next, which you described earlier in the show as the symbol of the Western vegan society, and it is a incredibly familiar flower to us, not just sunflowers in gardens and in fields and fields of sunflowers, but in art, and we'll move on to those things a little later on in the discussion. But let's talk about where the sunflower originated from in the first place.
Where it originated, and also why I included it, because mm-hmm. the sunflower led me on a bit of a wild goose chase, mm-hmm. I'm afraid. The reason I included it, remember I'm looking at flowers that have exerted power or influence, was that I'd read that it was sacred to various Central American and South American mm-hmm. civilizations, and I'd always wanted the flowers in the book to come from around the world, so I thought, okay, this is wonderful, I have to go for the sunflower. And the information was rather vague, and whenever facts sort of slide around a bit, you know you're in trouble. People said it was sacred to the Aztecs, mm. or was it the Mayans, or was it the Incas? Nobody was giving a proper reference. And when I looked into it, I could find absolutely no evidence of the sunflower being sacred to any of those civilizations. Although I did find a rather wonderful reference to it in a merchant's banquet among the Aztecs. And it was in one of the early chronicles. The early chronicles were compiled by the Spanish monks very soon after the Spanish conquest. And there's this merchant's banquet where honoured guests are given tobacco tubes and shield flowers, they're called, which are almost certainly sunflowers. And it was a night of feasting and the telling of visions and the eating of magic mushrooms and the beheading of a quail at one point, and a lot of singing and dancing and carousing until dawn. But not sacred, nothing mm-hmm. sacred there. The sunflower, it turns out, there's slight dispute about this, but it seems to be one of the very few food plants that was domesticated in the southern United mm-hmm. States. There was a time when it was thought that actually it was in further south, in what's now Mexico, that it was domesticated. But it seems, it may have been simultaneous, but it was almost certainly domesticated very early in southern United States. Came to Europe with the Spanish, mm-hmm. after the Spanish conquest, caused an absolute furore when it came here, because when you think about it, this flower is so huge and vigorous and unlike anything we've seen in gardens. And there were reports of sunflowers growing to something like 18 feet in Madrid. And I think it was only a rather paltry 8 feet in Belgium, which is sort of colder and wetter and damper. So caused a furore, and everyone just wanted them for their gardens. So they appear in all the early Florilegia, which are these books of ornamental flowers, sort of 16th century, early 17th century. And then it kind of falls out of favour because it is a bit of a brute.
Yeah, this is what I was going to come on to next. It goes in and out of fashion over the centuries.
Yes, yes, very much so. Because I think once you'd stopped being amazed at its size, it kind of dominates a garden in a way that possibly you don't necessarily want. But it did, it retained a very important early role from 17th century, we're talking of the West now, as a symbolic flower, a flower that was symbolic of yearning and devotion, because it is supposedly heliotropic, which means that it supposedly follows the sun. And so you get these great paintings like Van Dyck's Self-Portrait with a Sunflower, where you've got Van Dyck looking over his shoulder towards the audience. He's pointing over at this giant sunflower which fills the background, and he's fingering a gold chain which was given to him by his patron, Charles I. Whole books have been written, literally, about the meaning of this one single painting. So I'm not going to spend the rest of our time trying to tell you what the painting means, except to point out one rather, I think, significant problem, which is that the sunflower is not properly heliotropic. Yes, the buds do sort of turn a little bit, and I believe the leaves of wild sunflowers follow the sun. But when you think about it, the head of a sunflower is on this great thick stalk. It can't track the sun. But whenever I say this to anyone, you know, sunflowers don't follow the sun, they say, no, you're absolutely wrong. Of course they do, because it's something we have just been conditioned to believe. So whenever I see a field of sunflowers, and I was among the sunflowers at Kew in the summer, I photograph them just to prove to myself and anyone who might be willing to believe me that they face any which way. You know, they have not all neatly tracked the sun. But you're right, it does, it goes in and out of fashion. It became, in the sort of language of flowers and the symbolism of flowers, for a long time it had this notion of yearning. And then it became, towards the end of the 19th century, with the aesthetic movement and Oscar Wilde, he was a great supporter of both the lily and the sunflower. And he talks of the precious loveliness of the lily and the gaudy, leonine beauty of the sunflower.
One imagines Wilde being attracted to the sunflower because of its vulgarity and its sort of unpopularity at that time, I think.
He actually went further because he went over to America, and often when he gave a lecture, his entire audience would be sitting with a sunflower in its hand. Because you wore them on your clothes, you know, you had these on your skirts, velvet skirts with sunflowers, and on domestic objects. But no, in one of his lectures, he actually talks about why these are the favourite flowers, and it was to do with aesthetic reasons, because he said that they are perfect in design, and they were tied in with the meaning of life, and the meaning of life is art or beauty, or, you know, very much a flower of the aesthetic movement. And among all the objects that they produced, there's one which they actually showed at the V&A when they had an exhibition on the aesthetic movement and the cult of beauty, and it's a hermaphrodite teapot created by the Worcester Porcelain Factory, and on one side of the teapot there's a sort of lovelorn maiden with a floppy purple hat and a calla lily pinned to her breast, and on the other side there's a very foppish gent with a sunflower on his rather unpleasant green jacket, which was a very popular colour. It was called greenery yellowy or something like that, and he's got a sunflower. It's a hoot. And on the bottom of the teapot, there's an inscription that reads something about, this is warning of the fearful consequences of obeying the laws of natural selection and living up to one's teapot. Sounds wonderful.
An anti-Darwinian teapot.
Yes. Darwin comes into the story of my flowers, but we'll get on to Darwin
a little bit later on.
Yes.
So at this same time that we're talking about then, working away somewhere in obscurity at the time in France, is the person who nowadays we would most associate with the Sunflower and the artistic movement.
Is, of course, Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. And having sort of laughed with the aesthetic movement over their teapots, I actually found Van Gogh's Sunflowers hugely moving.
Mm, absolutely.
Because he writes about them to his brother Theo. He's gone down to the south of France and he's hoping to be joined by Paul Gauguin, and they're going to have this new beginning, this wonderful era of creativity. And he starts painting these sunflowers and he's writing to Theo about them and about how they represent all his hopes for the future. And Gauguin keeps delaying, does eventually come, and they stay together in Arles for only 9 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then it all falls apart, and Van Gogh apparently threatened Gauguin with a knife, then turned it on himself and cut off part of his ear and shut himself away in the brothel. So his wonderful, you know, this huge splurge of hope and creativity just comes to nothing. And I found the letters hugely moving. I think, maybe I'm alone in this, but I had begun to feel, whenever I saw a reproduction of one of Van Gogh's Sunflowers, oh, not one of those again. But having read what they really meant to him, now that they've got back their mm-hmm. meaning for me, and yes, I find them both, you know, full of hope, but ultimately tragic.
And I guess as well, perhaps it's just that the familiarity, you're likely to see that reproduction on a placemat or a tea towel.
And of course. Yes. Yes, I love the things that get onto tea towels.
Just to finish off on the Sunflower then, and somewhat more prosaically than its resonances through art, but possibly the way in which it's shaped our world more than anything else, is in terms of its oil.
In terms of its oil. And it was originally a food plant, you know, not this great sacred plant that I set off in search of. But yes, and it became very important in Russia. But it was said that during the Russian Lent, there was a whole list of things that you couldn't eat because you weren't allowed to eat oils and fats and good things in Lent. It was a time of stripping everything bare, and there's a prescribed list of things you couldn't touch. And the sunflower, because it's not native there, wasn't on the list, but it must have come in from somewhere. And therefore people started to eat it and grow it because they were able to in Lent. And it became very important, particularly in the Ukraine, for growing, and also back over in the United States.
Prairie country, basically. Mile after mile of
Kansas.
Sunflowers.
Yes, yeah. I think it's the state flower of Kansas. Mm-hmm. So yes, mile after mile. And I include in the book the rather famous poem by Allen Ginsberg, Sunflower Sutra.
I'm Alex Krotowski, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's move on to the next flower then, which is the opium poppy. Now we would think of Afghanistan or something when one imagines the opium poppy, and of course we'll get on to the opium wars and China in a little while. But surprisingly, it does look like the origin of the poppy is in Europe rather than Asia.
And is in around the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. Yes, that surprised me because I'd always associated it with, well, as you say, the badlands of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But it's a plant of the Mediterranean and then moves east. So again, it was as a food plant. But also, the earliest known equation of the opium poppy with anything sacred or the gods and goddesses is there's a little statue of, she's called the poppy goddess, was discovered on Crete. Mm-hmm. And she has a headdress with clearly three opium poppy capsules in her headdress. And she's holding up her hands and she has a sort of beatific smile on her face. She was discovered in a cave with a whole lot of paraphernalia, which suggested that the burning of opium to create opium vapours may have been part of her cult. Mm-hmm. So whether that's what her beatific smile is all about, I don't know.
Well, this is where I was going to go next, and how early those properties of opium were first known. And I want to talk about both sides of that. So we'll talk first of all about the various applications in medicine, and then onto its more recreational
yes.
properties. But so how early then, beyond that, the poppy goddess, you know, those Minoans have got there again, how early beyond that do we know that people would be regularly using the poppy as a medicinal plant?
Well, certainly the ancient Greeks knew of the opium poppy. Is, I think, everything to do with it is paradoxical, because it has been alternately feared and applauded. You know, it was recognised that it was wonderful at assuaging pain, but that it was also very dangerous. And Theophrastus, who's called the father of botany, talks about various different poppies, but he doesn't seem to include the opium poppy. Unlike Hippocrates, who produced a lot of works that were used by midwives, and it was almost as if Theophrastus was frightened of mentioning it. I mean, he must have known about it, whereas Hippocrates and the midwives was used. I can't be absolutely certain here, and we'd need to talk to a historian of science to be absolutely certain. But as I say, hated and applauded, and the Elizabethans, for instance, called it Joan's silver pin, which is a reference to it being fair without and foul within. And they would very often write within their herbals and within their medical books of the dangers of opium. Although then, later on, you get whole books written in praise of opium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quite dangerous ones if you read them without a sense of, I don't know, irony or whatever.
Well, I guess that's where we're going to go next, and we'll look at its part in the those sort of artistic movements. And, you know, we mentioned Tennyson before, and let's bring in De Quincey as well. Thomas De Quincey, I guess, who is the most famous proponent of opium.
An enormous number of people throughout the 19th century were doped out of their minds.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
On
certainly all of those romantic poets.
Yes. Wordsworth, apparently not.
No, this is true.
Although,
no, Wordsworth, even, and they all basically took a rise out of Wordsworth for being stuffier the time.
But his sister talks of going out for a walk. She goes, spent a lot of my childhood up in the Lake District.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very close to sort of Wordsworth and his sister and so on. And she talks about going for a walk on Loughrigg, which is just opposite from Ambleside, where I used to live, and getting very wet and aches and pains, so she comes home and takes laudanum. But De Quincey, it was interesting to read his Confessions of an Opium Eater, is that the right
mm-hmm.
thing? Which I obviously knew of mainly through French literature, because it gets translated in Baudelaire does a version, and to me, a lot of his visions in Confessions of an Opium Eater are rather like the French poet Rimbaud,
mm-hmm.
those sort of crazed, wonderful, full of crocodiles and Nilotic mud and strange people, and they are crazed visions. But like a lot of his contemporaries, De Quincey started taking laudanum, which is a tincture of opium, for medical reasons,
mm-hmm.
and then they just got hooked. Wilkie Collins was another one who consumed enormous amounts of laudanum. Most of them did.
Mm. And not only them, and of course all of those people were, even at the time, seen as slightly mad and dangerous bohemians. But let's face it, Queen Victoria was basically doing exactly the same thing.
Yes, and the royal family, and just... Yeah,
I want to sort of stick around that time, really, because, you know, we could talk about how the latter day synthesis of opium has, you know, again diverged down two ways. So on the one hand, we've got morphine; on the other hand, we've got heroin.
We've
and
got
of course,
heroin yes.
would be considered, you know, about as evil and bad a thing as you could possibly conceive of in this day and age. And, you know, the government has multi-million-pound campaigns against it, of course. But we're going to talk about a period of time when it was slightly different. As I mentioned, Victoria obviously being keen on the laudanum, but I want to talk about the extraordinary time of the opium trade and the opium wars,
and
basically.
The opium wars, which must be one of the most shocking periods,
absolutely,
in our entire history. We really ought to know more about this. We fought two opium wars against China, one in the late 1830s and the other was about 20 years later. So the opium wars are always described in the plural. And they were essentially trade wars. Britain went to war with China because the Chinese authorities were getting worried that the population was beginning to smoke a lot of opium. Mm-hmm. And the opium was coming in illegally or illicitly from British India. Mm-hmm. And the East India Company was very much involved in this illicit trade. Britain went to war with China to make sure that China accepted imports of opium from British India.
We have to reiterate that. This is, you know, while now we would imagine opium as something that would come from China, this is a time when the British government were forcing opium on a China that didn't want it.
That didn't want it, exactly. And they fought two lots of wars, and each time they won. And with the final wars, China was forced to legalise the import of opium. Legalise and regulate, so mm-hmm. I don't think it was totally unregulated, but was forced to accept imports of opium, was forced to pay huge indemnities to Britain and France, and also to cede Hong Kong to the British. So the recent handover of Hong Kong mm-hmm. is actually a hang-up from the Opium Wars. Did you hear about that when the handover was going on? No,
certainly
it was just
didn't.
Completely silent. And there is an irony that while we were forcing China to accept opium from British India, the Chinese were re-exporting their opium-smoking habits back to the West.
Yes, it does come back to bite us again. When I said we have an image of Chinese opium, that's born out of, you know, the man with a twisted lip and some lascar running an opium den in Limehouse or something. And again, perhaps, you know, the American image of it would be people building the railways and smoking opium and stuff across the country. So it comes full circle.
It comes full circle, and it came through with the gold rush, the mm-hmm. Californian gold rush. Chinese workers were coming into San Francisco initially and then spreading out over California. And they were bringing entire support communities with them. So laundries, restaurants, and opium dens. And for some time you could buy opium legally. I think it was mainly the Chinese secret societies who were selling it, and it was all very much, not so much underground, but it was hidden away. And then opium started being smoked by the daughters, or the sons and daughters of America, and everyone woke up to how dangerous it was. And the first wave of American attempts to stop opium smoking was not so much to make it illegal, but they introduced a whole series of exclusion laws where they excluded people who were likely to indulge in opium smoking and corrupt mm-hmm. everyone else, which, again, I mean, it's a really strange and rather a nasty way of going about assuming that a particular group of workers and women from China were particularly excluded.
And it still, I mean, it continues to come back and bite us. You know, we fought a war in Afghanistan, one of the aims of which was the eradication of the poppy crops, the opium crops, and you know, the British area of Helmand has just this very year released the greatest ever yield of crop.
And there was, for a time, it was said, although I had to be very, very careful because, you know, one needs to go into the facts a lot more, that the Taliban, for a time, were said to be clamping down on the production of opium. But then things seemed to change, and so I didn't go into that fully because I couldn't, within the kind of time and the resources I had, I couldn't really find out what was going on.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. I'm talking to Jennifer Potter about her book Seven Flowers and How They Shaped Our World. And Jennifer, I want to move us on to the rose, which, as I said in the introduction, is a flower that you've written a whole book about previously. So I guess, first of all, I want to know why you thought it was necessary to revisit it in this book.
I had spent 5 years researching and writing the history of the rose, the cultural history of the rose, and produced this very big book. And I had always wanted to write something that was much shorter, that would take you through the story of the rose without, you know, rose lovers might want to read this whole book, but I wanted to do something that would capture the essence of the rose, if you'd like. So that was one reason. But also, I think I couldn't have written a book like this without including the rose. The rose has so many different resonances to so many cultures and so many societies around the world that it would be odd if I didn't include it. I have to say, I loved writing the rose chapter. I was slightly, not dreading it, but I thought, you know, I have visited this territory before. But it was just wonderful to sit down and to let it all just come out in a sort of clear and elegant... I don't know if it's elegant, but...
It is elegant.
It is, thank you. And one of the questions I was asking myself was, the rose has so many resonances, what about other flowers? And how does the rose compare with other flowers? And I did, for this book, but it's not in the in the rose book, stumble across this little book. It's called The Speech of Flowers, produced during the years of Oliver Cromwell. It's the rose calls together all the other flowers to complain about being dethroned by this upstart tulip, spelled T-O-O-L-I-P, tulip, who's just sort of a foreigner who's come in from nowhere and is little more than a weed and has absolutely no benefit to healing, to perfume, and yet it's dethroned the Queen of Flowers. And the flowers all talk about the tulip and the rose, and they end up deciding that, yes, the rose remains the Queen of Flowers. And the upstart tulip is thrown on the dung heap, which I thought was rather wonderful. And in a way, well, all my flowers are doing this, but the flowers are talking to themselves from one chapter to another, and there are conversations going on. So I couldn't not include it, and I'm very glad I did.
You mentioned the importance of the rose to a lot of world cultures. Everybody will be familiar with its sort of resonances in English culture, right from, you know, royal houses and, you know, quintessential country gardens.
And the Tudor rose.
Indeed, and the sort of cliche of the English rose. Tell us about some of the other countries that have the rose as a significant part of their culture that we might not be so familiar with.
What I was very pleased, when I was researching the big rose book, so many of the facts about the rose, or myths about the rose that we think of are true, were revealed as just that, as myth. But I was enormously pleased to find that the ancient Greeks named the rose as the flower of love. You have the wonderful poet Sappho writing in the 7th century BCE, and she, not many fragments of her poetry survive, but there is one where she describes the grove of Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and she plants in her poem, she plants roses at the shrine, and she says, and with roses the whole place is shadowed, and down from radiant shaking leaves sleep comes dropping. So you have the rose as the flower of love. Another culture that is absolutely infused with the rose is Iran. And towards the end of researching the rose book, I went with my brother and my sister-in-law and a cousin to Iran. And it was just before the disputed presidential elections of 2009. So we were very, very lucky to get in before things went really quite difficult for Westerners travelling there. And wherever we went, and the rose is prevalent in poetry, in painting, in architecture, wonderful domes of, there's a mosque in Isfahan with a sort of prickly rose stem going around it, tiles and growing everywhere. They weren't always the most beautiful roses. You would find them in scrubby courtyards, you know, really just with these few rather moth-eaten looking roses. And they also grew roses up the central carriageway of a dual highway going to a place called Kamsar, which is the centre of the rose distillation in Iran. And as we drove up early one morning, they were harvesting the roses from the central reservation of the road.
Unlike some of the other flowers of the seven that we're talking about, is particularly tenacious in the wild. So when did we start cultivating it as a flower that people prized for their gardens?
Okay, now the rose is native, and we should remember this, only to the northern hemisphere. Mm-hmm. There are no native roses from the southern. We've talked about this already, the Minoans growing roses, so 3,500 years ago, but they're clearly still wild briars. Mm-hmm. Then you begin to get reports of the rose being used in perfume. And then when you look after that at the writings of say, the historian Herodotus, Greek historian, 5th century BCE, he talks about roses. He refers to the Garden of Midas having 60 petaled roses, and sweeter smelling than anything that anyone had known. Now, the wild briar, most roses have 5 petals. There's one that has 4. So already by then you're getting these 60-petaled roses. And then I think it's Theophrastus, 3rd century BCE, who describes people bringing, it's in an area of Macedonia, bringing roses, the best roses from the wild, into their gardens. And that is the start of, that's how you domesticate a shrub or a plant, turn it from a wild flower to a garden flower. That's the process that starts. But yes, the rose is immensely tough and a complete thug. The prickles is part of its survival strategy. You know, you put out prickles so that you don't get eaten by predators and animals, and tough as old boots is the rose.
And when does that, and again, there's obviously a lot of cultivated flowers, but if I imagine a catalogue from a nursery of cultivated flowers for sale, it would probably be roses. And when does that mass sort of market gardening of those flowers begin in earnest?
Well, I mean, you can trace it. I mean, the Elizabethans and the Stuarts. So John Gerard, his wonderful herbal, which was 1597. And then another of my favourites is John Parkinson of 1629, wrote this great big book of garden flowers. He called it, there's a terrible pun in the title, Paradisi in Sole, Paradisus Terrestris. Sorry, I'm not a Latin scholar, so apologies if I've got it wrong. But it translates as park in sun, you know, earthly paradise. And his name was Parkinson. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Sorry. Well, that is a terrible joke.
That is a terrible, terrible joke. Very badly explained. So you've got, what is interesting is to see how from 1597 to 1629 you start getting more and more roses, and then, well, and other flowers too, but we're talking about roses. And then of course it was really after the China roses started coming in towards the end of the 18th century that you got this huge explosion in rose breeding, because they brought in all sorts of different genes and qualities. Particularly valued was the quality of repeat flowering, because until then there'd really only been the damask rose. One of the damask, the autumn damask, flowers a second time. And you'd started to get some Portland roses before the China roses came in that would also repeat flower. But that's really when there's a huge explosion.
I'm Eric Schlosser, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
I've sort of raised that idea of the mass cultivation for sale, really to bring us on to our next flower, which is the tulip, which all of the other flowers in this book have some sort of utility, some sort of point, be they edible, be they medicinal. The tulip has nothing really to offer.
Has nothing really to offer.
Beyond its beauty, beyond its visual appeal, it has no utility. Beyond that, when it becomes a mass marketable product, which is an interesting story in itself, which we'll get onto.
And so the reason I included it was not for its utilitarian benefits, but because it exerted an economic influence.
An unbelievable economic
influence. And an unbelievably disastrous economic push. And this all happened. Some tulips are native to Europe, but the European mania for tulips began when tulips from the Ottoman Empire, from Constantinople, mm-hmm. started coming in to Europe. And we're talking sort of the 1550s, and they caused absolute wonderment, particularly because very early on you started getting these extraordinary colours, breaking colours. They were described as being flamed or feathered, and you might have a white background and this wonderful red markings, or they caused astonishment. And what nobody quite realised was that it was caused by a virus. And these wonderful markings were actually appearing on plants that were sick. And the great scholar Clusius, he was writing towards the end of the 1500s, and he died in about 1609. He was he trained in medicine, as the early botanists did, and then had this huge fascination for plants. And he was a great observer of plants and would only write about ones that he had observed carefully. He notes that the most wonderfully marked and coloured flowers of the tulip would die quite soon after. It appeared to be evidence of weakening. And he was absolutely right. And it was only really around the time of the First World War that we finally understood what was going on.
The other obvious ironic thing about the tulip is its name. I mean, its name itself is basically a mistake.
Oh, the name. Yes, of course it was. The Ottomans adored flowers, and they used to wear their favourite flowers in their turbans. And the word for tulip was lale, and they were described as lale tulband, meaning that they were sort of turban tulips. This tulband was heard as tulipan, and that's how they became known in the West, but it was really a complete mishmash.
Let's get on to this. You mentioned the economic impact of the tulip mania, which is like, it really reads like something invented by Jonathan Swift, but this is like a thing that happened.
Yes, it does. And there are also wonderful parallels with the economic crash of 2007.
Absolutely, and the dot-com boom.
And everything. So all these wonderful tulips were coming in from Constantinople and Ottoman Turkey, and they were coming over in extraordinary numbers, and people just went wild for them. And Clusius talks about how he was particularly fond of the tulip. He was very happy to exchange flowers with other and send flowers to other cultivated flower lovers. But everyone was getting excited by the tulip, and people started to buy and sell, and prices just went up and up and up. And Clusius found this, some of his precious tulips were being stolen because suddenly they have this economic value, but also he was being pestered for them. And the bulbs were sold at auction, so they were sold when not in flower, and prices just rose dramatically. And all sorts of non-flower lovers came into the market, and you would bid for tulip. Remember, you're buying a bulb, and the most precious ones are actually sick flowers. So you're paying a fortune, possibly with money you don't have, because you want to be able to sell it on so that you will then make a profit. And we're talking, this was sort of the early 1630s, price went up, and the most expensive tulip was a Semper Augustus. There were only 5 known bulbs of it, and they were all owned by the same person who kept refusing to sell them. But at the height of tulip fever, it was said that one bulb would be priced at the same, well, would cost you the same as an entire canal side house. One bulb. In Amsterdam. I mean, this is why they called it a windhandel, a trade in wind. And this is why I say it's very like the 2007-2008
economy. Absolutely.
You know, because you're buying something you don't understand in the hope that you can just get rid of it, make a fast buck.
And something that doesn't have what's the end point?
What is the actual value of it? And then, of course, the unthinkable happened. It was inevitable. It was the 3rd of February, 1637. An auction was being held. Bag of tulips, bulbs put up for sale. Nobody bid. Price was dropped. Nobody bid. And the entire auction failed. And as soon as that happened, and I think the market had begun to be a little jittery. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the economic crash had to come. One had to stop behaving like this. And so it just completely crashed. An American scholar called Anne Goldgar has gone back to the original documents and tried to trace what actually happened. And it seems that, yes, the market crashed, but that there were fewer actual bankruptcies and that a lot of the anti-tulip stories you hear were put out by pamphleteers who were dead against the tulip and this stupid mania that for something that was beautiful, yes, but ultimately worthless. So, you know, the crash may not have been quite so disastrous as we once thought. And there's a very nice traveller. He appears in my biography of the Tradescants, Peter Munday. He's travelling through the Netherlands in 1640, and he notes incredible prices for tulips. So, and that was 3 years after the crash. Mm-hmm. So clearly there was still a market, but it had come a little to its senses.
We've come then to the last flower, the seventh flower, and I did say we were going to talk about all the flowers in some detail, but really I want to use the orchid to close the show, really, a final question. You already mentioned right at the top of the show that you weren't particularly keen on orchids as a flower when you went into this book, but you felt that they were something that had to be there. So really my question would be, what do you think of orchids now? What did you find during the writing of this book that changed your mind, if indeed your mind did change?
Yes, and my mind did change. I don't like cloned supermarket orchids, although you can see on my shelf over there's only one flower I have. It's not in flower at the moment, and it is a little wild-looking orchid. Yes, I very quickly became hooked by the orchid and remain fascinated by it. And to me, the most interesting thing about the orchid is the difference in perceptions of the orchid between Eastern cultures, particularly Chinese cultures, and the West. Remember, I'm investigating sort of cultural aspects of these flowers, and I found that fascinating. In China, ever since the time of Confucius, the orchid has been equated with the superior man. Mm-hmm. The orchid in China is a flower that it will flower unseen and unappreciated in the deepest valley. Just so will the superior man strive for virtue even while living in poverty and distress. That's the Eastern view, so it's very gracious, it's very superior, and it's one of the four gentlemen of flowers that appears in Chinese paintings. So very refined, very elegant, very beautiful. The West, I think the clue to how we look at the orchid comes in its name, orchid. It comes from orchis, which is Greek for testicle. And in the West, ever since the ancient Greeks, the orchid has been seen as an aphrodisiac, its medical effect. It was said that if a man ate the larger of the two orchid roots, he would beget male children. If a woman ate the smaller, she would conceive girls. So it's been connected to sex. And I find these two aspects completely fascinating. And for me, the orchid, I'm so pleased it is my last flower, because I came on to Charles Darwin. And for Darwin, the orchid was his favourite flower. His very second book, after Origin of Species, was devoted to the orchid. And he uses the orchid to help prove his theory of natural selection and to prove the fact that flowers in the natural world, well, things in the natural world, aren't created perfect from the start, but that they evolve strategies to survive. And the orchid has some very, very cunning strategies. It will disguise itself, appearing to offer pollinators, insects, and very particular insects, either food or sex. When I was looking, when I was researching the book, I was up in the Northwest, where I really come from, and with a family friend, she took me to look for wild orchids, and we found, just by a grass verge, wonderful little fly orchids. Mm-hmm. And I've taken photographs of them, and they look just like insects. And they're trying to attract passing insects of the same apparent species to think, oh, there's a lady fly. And there are other very ugly, there's a night flowering Bulbophyllum, which is a genus of orchid, that has these sort of really horrid green dangly bits. And botanists speculate that exists in, it grows in Papua, an island off the coast of Papua New Guinea. These dangly bits resemble a sort of slime mould that grows in the area. And it's trying to attract night-feeding midges, convincing them that they will get food if they land on these dangly bits. I'm afraid, poor midges, they are conned. So it was, I felt the orchid, you know, I started with creation myths in the book, and good heavens, we end with Charles Darwin using a flower to help prove what might really have happened. And for me, that was the end of the book.
That's a perfect place for us to finish then. So I have been talking about seven flowers and how they shaped our world, which is out now from Atlantic Books. And I've been talking to Jennifer Potter about the book. So Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Neil, thank you very much indeed. It's been great fun.
I'm Jonathan Meads, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So I'm on the phone with writer and critic Andrew Muller. And Andrew, I've asked you to choose something to talk about, and you're going to tell me about, well, something you described to me as your favourite album of the 21st century to date. So what is it?
It's Southern Rock Opera by Drive-By Truckers.
So who are Drive-By Truckers, first of all, I guess?
Drive-By Truckers are a band from, mostly now based in Athens, Georgia, but originally from various parts of Alabama. For want of a less pejorative description, you would describe what they do as Southern rock musically. They are pretty unreconstructed on that front, but there's great lashings of sort of Southern soul heritage and a certain quantity of country going on as well. They've existed for about the two main protagonists in the group, Cooley and Mike Cooley, that is, and Patterson Hood, have been playing together for decades, but I think Drive-By Truckers have existed since roughly the late 90s, and Southern Rock Opera, if I've done my maths right, was their third album.
You just mentioned the idea of Southern Rock. Well, Patterson Hood himself doesn't like that term, does he? It's a quite a reductive description.
Patterson has, I think he has certain issues with all sorts of caricatures of the South, and what makes, I think, his band interesting and his writing interesting, but especially this album interesting, is his attempts to resolve his own extremely mixed feelings about where he grew up. And he has, as he's pointed out many times before, had a very unusual Southern upbringing in that, on the one hand, he did grow up in Alabama in the 70s. His father, David Hood, was one of the house musicians, the bass player at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals. So while Patterson was growing up in George Wallace's Alabama, his father was playing bass on all these fantastic soul records by people like Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, Percy Sledge, etc., 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 which I think would give you a strange perspective on growing up in a place like that. And what I think a lot of Patterson's writing is about, and this album in particular, is his attempts to reconcile what he does call, in fact, on Southern Rock Opera, the duality of the Southern thing.
And we'll talk more about that in a minute. But the album itself first, then, I mean, you've hinted at this already, but it could be described as that often terrible thing, the concept album.
It is a concept album. It is an utter and unabashed concept album, and indeed it's a double concept album, so that's about as old school as it gets. And while I don't own a vinyl copy, I'd be willing to bet money it comes with a really opulent gatefold sleeve. All they really, really lack is a twin-necked guitar, which I'm pretty sure they don't own. But yeah, it is a concept album. It is a concept album loosely based on a semi-fictional rock group called Betamax Guillotine, who, as it turns out fairly quickly, are an extremely thinly veiled avatar for Lynyrd Skynyrd. And so what the album actually kind of is a chronicle of Lynyrd Skynyrd's quite literal rise and, as it turned out, fall. But they use that as a framework for hanging various observations of the South and their upbringing in it. Rather weirdly, in one of those full circle turning things, Drive-By Truckers, I know, have on a few occasions actually opened for Lynyrd Skynyrd or the surviving members of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I did once ask Drive-By Truckers, you know, what that relationship is like, and coolly just deadpanned, you know, they actually, it was Patterson, I remember, just saying, yeah, they really do think the album is kind of weird, which you can well imagine.
Indeed. So this duality of the Southern thing then, which is, I mean, this is, it's a thing that I guess people would be familiar with. In cliche terms, we could say, you know, this idea of the South as, yes, there was segregation and slavery and lynchings, but, you know, everybody's really polite, have some pulled pork. How does he talk about it on the album?
Patterson's rendering of the Southern thing is a little bit more subtle than that. I mean, I've talked about this record with Patterson a bit, and he does, to my complete lack of surprise, cite as a major inspiration for it Randy Newman's Good Old Boys, which is also a brilliant and very, very brave and thoughtful dissection of a lot of those contradictions about the South. But it's, I think what Patterson's getting at is right there in that song Rednecks by Randy Newman, in which, you know, he does make the point that the caricature of the South is largely a creation of the North, which in all sorts of respects is no less racist than the South, and in some respects one could argue actually more so. So that, I think, is more where Patterson is going with his idea of the duality of the Southern thing, that it is, on the one hand, you know, it does have this past and this history, and the caricature, like most caricatures, is rooted in a measure of truth. There needs to be something for caricatures to work with. But it does also have this, you know, astonishing heritage, possibly as a result of that, of literature, of music, and you could also argue even of social progress. When you actually look at the great titanic figures of modern American liberalism, and whatever you may think of them, you know, figures like Martin Luther King, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, they're all Southerners. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned already George Wallace, who was a long-standing governor of Alabama, who crops up numerous times across this album as a good exemplar of that, of the contradictions.
George Wallace is enshrined throughout the record as the great embodiment of the Southern thing, and I think it's important to note that at no point does any of the writing on this endorse George Wallace or indeed characterise him as anything other than at best a thoroughgoing scoundrel. But it does make the point that, yeah, he was to all intents and purposes a governor of Alabama literally for decades and decades. And decades. Alabama was, to a certain extent, a somewhat bizarre banana republic governed by this charismatic populace, who, it's important to remember, did run for the Democratic nomination for president in 1972, I think, and might even have got it had he not been shot and crippled en route. But he did run for president as a third-party candidate in 1968 and actually carried five states. He was the most successful third-party candidate in American presidential election history. But he ran initially for office as quite a progressive man for the period and lost. And then ran again as an absolutely hardline segregationist and won. And then later, I think Patterson, you know, quotes this statistic on the somewhere on the song The Three Great Alabama Icons. The last time he was returned to office, he was carried over the line by an enormous plurality of the black vote. So there is always that question about, was Wallace, you know, just an utter cynic who'd say whatever it took, or was he a man who changed as the times changed and as his state changed? The best description I've ever heard myself of that, by the way, was I spent some time in Montgomery, Alabama a few years ago and did speak to a long-serving Alabama civil servant who had worked for George Wallace, as many, many people in Alabama have. And I did ask him the question, was Wallace a racist who had an epiphany, or was he just a politician who just wanted to get elected? He smiled in that lovely sort of dry, droll way that Southerners have of speaking. He just said, George was always real good at noticing which way the parade was headed and getting out in front of it. Which I think is a lovely description of political leadership, I think.
Mm-hmm. How does this album fit in with the rest of the oeuvre of Drive-By Truckers, then?
It's the album in which I think they first realised how good they were. There were two albums before that, and one live album. And they're not bad, those albums. They have their moments, but there's a little bit of a fear of seriousness. You can kind of tell that from their titles. They were called Gangsta Billy and Pizza Deliverance. There's some really, really good songs on them, some really good songs. Songs like Nine Bullets by Patterson, Uncle Frank, especially by Cooley, which is just an astonishing piece of writing. Bruce Springsteen would be proud of it. But I think there was a tendency to retreat into a tendency towards novelty country songs, mm-hmm. which are good novelty country songs, and there's nothing wrong with writing a novelty country song. There's a long and proud heritage of that, and anybody, you know, if you can write anything which can be even remotely compared with someone like Shel Silverstein, that's not a bad day's work. But I think Southern Rock Opera was a huge, I mean, from where they'd been, an absolutely epochal leap forward in ambition, and I think the fact that they actually pulled it off kind of surprised themselves, but I think it's given them real confidence to go on and become the band they've been since, which I do think is the most interesting band in America right now.
You mentioned that they're from, or they're based, generally in Athens, Georgia, which is one of those places that's slightly mythical as a place that a lot of music comes from, like Chapel Hill, North Carolina, or Olympia, Washington, or something, that's significant for that reason and not necessarily anything else. That seems to happen with quite a lot of American towns like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it varies, but it does become self-sustaining. Yeah. I mean, the reason that Athens, Georgia exists is because that's where the University of Georgia is.
Yeah, all of these places seem to be college towns.
Indeed, yeah. and the University of Georgia absolutely dominates Athens. The University of Georgia's football ground holds more people than live in Athens. Mm. But it does become self-sustaining because you get people who move to Athens because there was an interesting music scene, and the reason there's an interesting music scene is that lots of kids wanted to go to college in Athens because that's where REM came from. And that's the reason, I think I'm right in saying, Patterson moved to Athens, and he thought it would be an interesting town to meet musicians in and do music in. So these things do become self-sustaining because they attract like-minded people. And Athens, it's mostly due to REM, not exclusively. I mean, bands like Pylon and the B-52s also came from Athens, but REM, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world coming from such a small town, inevitably became a center of gravity. Patterson, I think I'm right in saying, he lives just up the street from Weaver D Soul Food Restaurant, whose sign out the front, of course, declares Automatic for the People, mm-hmm. which is where the album title comes from.
And I guess everybody lives up the street from the Soul Food Restaurant.
Well, indeed, it's not a big town.
In your earlier book, Rock and Hard Places, there's a fantastic account of you going on tour with Drive-By Truckers. So tell us a bit about that. What was that like?
That was huge fun, and that was the first time I'd met them properly. I think I'd spoken to Patterson on the phone a couple of times before then, but it was late 2008, it must have been, because it was right around the time of the presidential election, just beforehand, in fact. They were on tour with the Hold Steady, which was a sort of an interesting dichotomy of Southern Rock and Northern College Indie, for want of another less pejorative term. I went to Atlanta and Tallahassee on tour, traveling overnight between them on the Drive-By Truckers bus. And it was terrific fun. It's really nice when you go and meet a band that, you know, whose works you really admire and find out that they are off record pretty much like they are on mm-hmm. records, which is to say that first meeting, particularly Patterson, was extremely sort of garrulous and talkative and generous and all the rest of it, whereas I think Cooley said about four things to me in the entire period I was with the band, but they all went straight into the piece, because he does, I think more than any other person I've ever met, communicates almost solely in just eminently quotable one-liners, which doesn't surprise you at all when you listen to his songs, which are so incredibly economically constructed without a syllable wasted. And he does just have that knack for coming up with the zinger that just stays with you. But it was really good fun. It was one of those trips where it was the first time I'd done the thing of actually sleeping on the bus for ages, which is usually about the most disagreeable way to travel imaginable. But it was a fun few days.
Just one final question then, Andrew. Your own band, The Blazing Zoos, which is a country rock band. Do you think they've been influenced by Drive-By Truckers and particularly this album in any way?
I would dearly love my band to someday record something that would be remotely worthy of being considered of having been influenced by Drive-By Truckers, Southern Rock Opera. By far the highlight of our sporadic live career so far is that we did once open for Drive-By Truckers, which, I mean, for us probably felt no less weird than opening for Lynyrd Skynyrd does for Drive-By Truckers. But we opened for the Truckers at the Paradiso in Amsterdam in late 2010, which was in many respects entirely terrifying, but also really, really good fun. So, I mean, I'm not really sure I would be unhumble enough to claim them as a direct influence on the music that my band makes when my band makes it. But an album like Southern Rock Opera, rather, is just, it's one of those just generally inspiring things, because it exists in the world and reminds you that, you know, rock and roll can be about so much more than rock and roll.
That's brilliant then. So that was Andrew Muller talking about Drive-By Truckers' album Southern Rock Opera. Andrew, thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find Little Atoms on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do it at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.